Counsel?
I understand that you've reserved, Mr. Rosella, reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, proceed.
Good morning. The issue before and the appeal in this case concerns the question of whether plaintiff appellant Alana Durrett, a minor at the time she registered for the ACT examination, is contractually bound to an arbitration provision which was embedded in ACT's website. Ms. Durrett, at the time she completed her registration, read and checked the box and certified that she was the person signing the application, that the information contained in that application was accurate, and that she agreed to abide by all procedures. What is significant is the fact that the specific terms for the arbitration provision, which ACT is now attempting to bind her to, were not available and present at the time she signed. In fact, they were on a separate link, which registrants were not required to read and review before they completed the registration process.
Mr. Rosehill.
Okay, before we move on, what was on that page directly above her signature is an understanding, an agreement to binding arbitration itself. Is that correct?
That was on the page where she checked a box that said agree. The point that we're making is that the actual provisions, terms for arbitration were not present.
I assume we'll get to that, but I'm trying to see whether you acknowledged that there was agreement to some form of binding arbitration, and it's this specific arbitration, or whether your argument on this particular point, setting aside infancy, on this particular point is that there was no agreement. I'm just trying to get clarity as to the scope of your argument.
I think our point is, if you're going to compel her to agree to terms for arbitration, you must present those terms and not just strictly say arbitration and to be agreed to be bound by the test cancellation procedures. And it's our position that the cases that we cited, in particular the Speck decision and the Douglas case, Hawaii Supreme Court opinion, in both those cases found that where the provisions and terms for arbitration are not clearly set forth at the time the person either acknowledges, signs, or agrees to those terms, you can't hold them responsible. And in particular, the Douglas case, the court pointed out the fact, and what was the issue in that case was terms and conditions of arbitration provision contained in an employee handbook, which were 20 pages separate from where the person acknowledged and assigned. And the court in that case concluded that that was insufficient, that the terms and conditions were not brought and clearly and unambiguously to the attention. And I guess the point that the court was making, that if you were going to hold someone to arbitration terms and conditions, you have to conspicuously make sure that those terms and conditions are visible and are reviewed. The point in this case was the fact that ACT's registration process online, you could skip reading those terms and conditions. It wasn't required. In other words, you could finish the process without ever reading those terms and conditions for arbitration. And as an example, this court's own Hoiki website, you have to read the disclaimer in order to get to the search page to do your search. You can't skip the disclaimer provision. Same thing if you download a song from iTunes. You have to read their disclaimer to get to buying your song. That wasn't the case in this case.
Counsel, to clarify that point, what you need to do is you need to click to it and then say you've read it. You don't necessarily need to have read it. Is that right?
Correct. There was no obligation. And that's if ACT is going to hold them to that requirement, then it's incumbent upon them when they set up their website to make sure that's a requirement. And if you look at the Speck case, that's specifically what they found, is that the embedded provision regarding software agreement regarding arbitration had to be brought to the attention at the time they downloaded it, and it wasn't.
Do I recall Speck correctly, and that was an issue where the reference, the click here essentially was much further down the page, so they had to scroll much further?
Well, it wasn't included at the time when they accepted and agreed to download the software. That was the point in that case. The Speck Court pointed that out. And so it's our position that the same situation arose here. And what's more significant is the fact you're dealing with minor students, students who are registering. And students being students aren't going to read the details. They want to get to the meet, complete the process, and move on and sit for their test. And so our point is that ACT had the ability to rectify the decision and make it clear, this is what you're agreeing to. These are the terms and the conditions you're agreeing to. Written submissions in Dallas, Texas. It's binding arbitration, single arbitrator, and none of which was brought to the attention at the time a registrant would sign. And that's the concern we have. And in this case, it wasn't done the way it should have been done.
Counsel, can you explain to me then what's the effect of the person having to check off the box that says, I have read and I agree to these terms without, whether or not they've read it? That's the affirmative act.
They check off a box, but really, if you look at that, and it was Exhibit B to our underlying motion, if you look at it, the actual provision regarding test score cancellation is at the very end, and it says that to read the specific policies regarding arbitration, click here. But the click here wasn't mandatory. In other words,
I understand that. But by actually clicking the box that requires an affirmative act on the person's part, which says that I have read and understood, read and agree to these terms, is it your position then that that affirmative act is not meaningful?
It's meaningful just in the sense as an acknowledgement. But whether it was meaningful in the sense of bringing to their attention what they're agreeing to. I mean, if you're going to hold someone to an agreement, and then there has to be unambiguous consent to all terms and conditions, and that's our point. There wasn't all the terms and conditions which they assumed she agreed to at the time she registered weren't before her at the time. It'd be one thing to have those terms and conditions actually on that web page when she clicked, I agree. And that's not the situation here. And what's significant, what the spec court brought out was that there must be knowing consent to a particular provisions for arbitration. And the provisions in this case weren't knowingly consented to. And the court pointed out, clarity and conspicuous of arbitration terms are important in securing informed consent. And that's the issue, informed consent. Did Alana Durrett, when she registered and checked, I agree, was she informed of what she was consenting to? And it's our position she did not.
What would be the difference if the website was designed so that the terms of the specific terms of the arbitration were in front of you? You didn't have to click elsewhere, or as you say, before you could complete the registration process, you must go through a screen that contains those provisions.
Then I think ICT's case is a little easier because you have that informed consent. You have the terms and conditions presented to the registrant at the time. The same thing in ACT.
So if the person chooses not to read it and just scrolls down to the bottom and checks the box and says, I agree, then you're saying that your argument is weakened because the person had those terms in front of them?
She had the opportunity. She had the opportunity to read those because they're directly before her, and she couldn't proceed to complete the process, I agree to these terms, without, if they're there in front of her, it's a different case, and that's not the situation we have here. There was no requirement that she read it, and students being students, I would assume majority of them are not going to read that. They're going to click to completing the process. And ACT can't establish that, in fact, she read those terms and conditions which they're now holding her and requiring her that she be obligated to comply with. And that's the point that we're making here, that if they're going to hold her and require her to these terms and conditions, they were required to present them to her. And the point is, they committed a minor to agree to arbitration terms without confirming that those terms were read and understood. And that's a problem. And that's the significance of the cases that we cited to, again, as I said, the Douglas and Speck decision.
But counsel, factually, just to make absolutely sure, had she clicked on the button, she would have seen each and every one of the terms that she was ultimately asked
Well, you know, and that's an interesting question, because had she clicked on the button, not all the terms are actually laid forward. It says there's exclusive granting binding arbitration through written submission, and that what the issue for arbitration is, that whether or not ACT acted reasonably and in good faith.
Okay, so at the time of the registration, even clicking on the button, there were terms and conditions that were not disclosed.
Well, you know, the fact that she's waived, and that's nowhere on the website, she's waiving the right to proceed in a court of law versus strictly through arbitration.
Okay. Binding arbitration, I think you'd have to agree, if one agrees to binding arbitration, that is generally waiving your rights to your alternative, which is to go to court.
Mm-hmm. But again, if you and I were reading that, we would come to that conclusion. A minor reading that, most minors probably don't even understand the concept of arbitration, let alone the terms and conditions that flow and what they're agreeing to. And so, that's an issue that factors in here. We're dealing with high school students. High school students, their attention spans probably, if any of you have children, realize are very short. They want to get it done quick. So if you're going to hold these students in the registration process to these terms, you dang well better make sure they understand and actually have the terms in front of them.
Okay, well, let's talk about infancy, because I do have and not because I have a son, but I do have a son, and you're right, he's frequently one of these short attention span button clicking cowboys. But let's talk about infancy, and if we were to really get down into your infancy issue, what is the remedy? Because I think what you're arguing is the remedy here is to sever just the arbitration provision and not the rest of the agreement. And honestly, I have some problems with that, because I don't know how to say that someone cannot agree to X because of infancy, but they can agree to all of the other terms in this contract here. So maybe you can flesh that out for me.
Well, you know, the issue regarding infancy with respect to, obviously the court needs to come to the conclusion of whether or not the act of sitting for a college entrance exam falls within the category of necessary to determine whether or not she had the right to void that provision. The arbitration provision is part of the underlying agreement regarding the terms for term cancellation and for the registration process. There is case law that we've cited to that specific arbitration provision can be severed from the remainder of the contract and reviewed and stands on its own terms. And so it can look at the arbitration spirit, because it is a severable clause both under state and federal law, and make a determination.
But aren't those cases just to determine the formation of the contract itself?
I can't specifically answer that question. I don't know specifically if they went solely to the issue of formation. I just don't, without going back and reviewing the cases on that specific point. You know, the issue as to whether it was severable, clearly I think we take the position it was severable, because if it's severable and in turn it would be unenforceable because it is voidable under the infancy doctrine, then ACT's remedy is not through arbitration, it's got to go through the normal litigation process. And I think that's the result that would be appropriate under the circumstances, given whether or not this student particularly agreed to the terms and conditions at the time she registered. And as the Hawaii Supreme Court pointed out in the Pfluger decision, the purpose of the infancy doctrine is to protect the minor. And that's the issue and concerns that this court should focus on, is was the minor in this instance adequately informed, and were they protected from the course and the actions that ACT took in the registration process?
Counsel, if you're done with the severability issue that Judge Leonard asked you about, let me back up to infancy again, or rather necessities that you talked about. Your position is that this is not teaching and education. Would your position be any different if this was K through 12?
In terms of if it were involving a contractual provision regarding high school
entrance exams for K through 12?
again, you know, it hasn't specifically squarely been addressed. You know, the only cases we were able to locate were turn of the century cases, which went through the analysis and said that it may be necessary for purposes of an elementary school education, but not for college purposes. And so if it's not necessary for a college education, then sitting for an examination that gets you there doesn't fall within, at least within the four corners of those decisions, as being unnecessary.
Can you and I agree, though, that the importance of college these days is a little different than it was the turn of the century?
Well, you know, the issue is, and the importance of college is, yes, the importance of sitting for an examination, that's sort of a fine line distinction, but it is the issue here. Is sitting for a college examination necessary for a minor student? Certainly that's the issue. And under what we found, it doesn't seem to fall as being necessary for life and sustenance of a minor student in this situation. And so it would be our position that it doesn't fall in that category. And in under the circumstances of this case, she should be allowed to avoid it as a minor at the time that she registered. And the issue is, ACT knew she was a minor. They get information and personal information regarding student when the student registers, her age and so forth. So ACT could have done two things. Have the parents agree, and have the parents agree and acknowledge as, you know, the protectors of the minor. Or, as I said, have the terms and conditions actually before the minor so they can't avoid, and they clearly know what they're consenting to. And so that's what's problematic in the underlying facts of this case.
Are you saying, counsel, that any of the other warnings or notices regarding the arbitration procedure that ACT follows, that she got, you know, when she sat for the exam or at other points, that did not cure the problem?
No, because the same language on the website was also on the examination. Mm-hmm. And again, the point that we're making is that the specific terms and conditions were not on the examination. And if you were requiring in a minor to consent, unequivocal consent, as I mentioned, they need to be informed of what they're consenting to. And neither the test taking, the examination booklet itself, or the actual acknowledgement page at the time of registration included that. And so both forms of the acknowledgement didn't pass muster in our opinion. To hold this particular minor for the terms that she was agreeing to.
Getting back to Judge Reifer's question for a moment, what was the evidence? I recall something about maybe 3,000 colleges require ACT scores for their registration or admissions process. What was the evidence in terms of how essential taking the ACT test is to getting into the college of your choice?
You know, it's either the ACT or the SAT. Mm-hmm. Most colleges, there are a few that do not require, and more colleges are moving to that, not looking strictly at test scores, but the bigger picture of the quality of the student. But I think the colleges that Mr. Rett was applying to were required either the ACT or the SAT.
At page 20 of your opening brief, you say that in order to apply to the college of her choice, she needed to take the ACT. You reference her declaration, but I don't believe that her declaration actually says that. I'm wondering if you're familiar with any evidence in the record that says that.
It's my recollection, and I can't point specifically. It was my understanding that the colleges that she applied to, BYU, Colorado, and I believe Oregon, either required the ACT or the SAT. I don't have before me the ability to point to what was in the record as in fact the colleges that you applied to if they required that, and I apologize.
Counsel, it's up to you, but there is another issue that you raised in your brief that I wondered if you might want to address, and that's the issue concerning the contract of adhesion argument. And I think the way the case you cited Brown puts it, the contract has to unfairly limit the obligations and liability or otherwise unfairly advantage the stronger party. Now, clearly, this is a this particular procedure is helpful to ACT. But I guess I want you to address whether it's an unfair limitation considering what ACT does and the volume of students and services and the policy arguments ACT makes, which is, hey, the reason 3,000 schools ask for the ACT is because of the integrity of the process. And if they were, you know, called into court every time someone had this review, they couldn't do this.
You know, and there's two issues in that. Does it unfairly limit the obligations and liabilities or unfairly advantage? In this case, I think it clearly unfairly advantaged ACT as far as the terms and conditions were set forth. There's no bargain for exchange here. This clearly was, and I think in the Brown decision, the court agreed that the contract that was resulting from a course of bargaining between the parties, that standard had been met. So the first condition to find an adhesion contract had been met. And I think the same, based on the Brown decision, the first requirement to find an adhesive contract has been met. And so the issue really squarely falls on whether or not it unfairly advantages ACT. And without a bargain for exchange, I think it's skewed in favor of ACT because ACT sets the terms and conditions.
Right, but were the terms and conditions inherently unfair to Elena and other students who might find themselves wanting to challenge the process?
Well, you know, they have no input on the process. And secondly...
Right, but you wouldn't expect ACT to go out and...
I understand that.
...negotiate with tens of thousands of kids.
I think there's no issue or ability for the student... As an example, conduct discovery in the arbitration process to actually have a hearing. This is all by written submissions in Dallas, Texas. It would be another case if there were written submissions here in Honolulu, but the fact that the written submissions to Dallas, you know, takes it out of this jurisdiction and puts it in a separate and wholly different jurisdiction.
But that's what ACT tells us is the case, that it is assigned to an arbitrator in Honolulu.
But again, the fact that that's not in the terms and conditions, that it would be heard and determined by an arbitrator here in Honolulu. So again, if that's something that the position that ACT takes, but again, that's not made clear to the registrant at the time they register that, oh, by the way, you will have the right to have your claim reviewed by an arbitrator here in Honolulu.
There seems to be a difference in position between the two of you on who actually selects the arbitrator. I believe in your brief you said that ACT selected it, and ACT is arguing that no, it's AAA that selects the actual arbitrator. Is there something in the record that establishes that for us?
Well, you know, there was, you know, and I think there was a form that ACT submitted after they challenged the test scores that set forth the procedures, and I think it was attached as an exhibit to our underlying brief that sort of elaborated the process. And actually, if you challenge it and choose the option to challenge their invalidation of the test scores by arbitration, then the process is ACT sends an agreement to arbitrate. And that agreement to arbitrate has further all of the specific terms and conditions. But you don't see that. You don't get an opportunity to review that until you get to that point. And again, so it's like...
Gotcha.
There's no clear understanding, at least going into the registration process, what am I agreeing to? And that's the concern that we have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Miyagi.
Good morning, honorable judges of the Intermediate Court of Appeals. I think we should start with the analysis of the facts, if you will. I mean, the facts really aren't disputed. The plaintiff, Ms. Durrett, filled out the registration electronically, and as the questions have disclosed, she clearly checked the box saying she read the provisions. So if I listen to Mr. Rosehill's argument, the essence of it, if you will, is that the terms of the binding arbitration weren't convenient enough. And that's the essence of the argument, if I understand it. And if you look at the evidence that was submitted to Judge Kim when he found, in fact, that there was a binding arbitration agreement, all he had to do was click on it and the terms would have popped up.
Mr. Miyagi, would all of the terms that Elena was ultimately asked to adhere to, were all of the terms available when you clicked?
As Mr. Rosehill pointed out at the very end of his argument, there was a subsequent document that would have been sent out that would have talked about the details, for example, the payment of the registration fee and the rest of that sort of stuff and the details of how the communications were to be. Those were not in the link. The link just said you had binding arbitration, it was on written submission, it's in the record, Your Honor. So the essential terms were there, but not all of the terms. I don't want to mislead this court in any way, not every little detail. So the details of how you communicate, who was to pay the initial fees, that was not in the screen that you would have clicked on. But the essential term that would be binding arbitration was there. And all she had to do was click on it. And so the reliance upon the Douglas versus Pfluger case, I think, is misplaced by plaintiff as a basis to overturn Judge Kim's decision. And that is because that was a 60-page document. In this case, all she had to do was click it, and the link click, if you will, you can tell I'm not of the current electronic generation, is right there, right above the area where she checks electronically, of course. So all she had to do was click on it. So in terms of this new age, if you will, this was not buried. It was there. And I think, you know, as the Supreme Court said in Leong versus, make sure, the Kaiser Foundation case, which is cited in the briefs, you can't say, oh, I got a contract, but I didn't know the terms because I didn't read it. That's basic Hornbook law, Your Honor. So Judge Kim, we believe, clearly found that there was an arbitration agreement, and the terms, the material terms, were all there for her to review. She said she did, but by clicking, but in her declaration, she said she never read it. So for the purposes of Judge Kim's decision, those are the undisputed facts. She clicked it, certifying that she, in fact, had read it, and in her declaration, she says, well, I may have clicked it, but I didn't read it. So those facts are undisputed, but based upon those undisputed facts, Judge Kim found that there was an arbitration agreement that was binding, and we believe that it should stand up. So there was no disputed material fact. Those facts and the conclusion of law based upon those undisputed facts, we believe, supports Judge Kim's decision. Now, if you go on to the infancy and the adhesion agreement arguments by the plaintiff, those are the main grounds for setting aside this arbitration agreement. And infancy, they rely upon the Douglas case. But in the Douglas case, the court stated they are allowed to contract for, they being minors, they are allowed to contract for their benefit with power in most cases to recede from their contract, but in their contract for necessary, such as board, apparel, medical aid, teaching and instruction, and other necessaries, they are absolutely bound and may be sued and charged in execution. Well, I would present to this court the postulation that, notwithstanding the two turn-of-the-century cases cited by Mr. Rosehill, that a college education is a necessary. And to get the college education, you got to take these tests. I don't think anyone's arguing that. So I think the infancy argument falls by the wayside based upon the language in the Douglas versus Pfluger case. It is a necessary in this day and age.
Does the fact that there are alternative testing agencies weaken that argument?
I don't believe so. For example, I mean, that sort of approach to medical care, I mean, a child is bound to the contract if he or she seeks medical care. There's multiple doctors, multiple hospitals you could go to. And then with respect to the argument that just because she was 17 at the time, you know, should be a reason to get her out of reading the hyperlink, if you will, that contain the arbitration terms. If one goes into, for example, a medical malpractice area, a child of 17 is still bound by the informed consent that he or she gives to the doctor for the treatment of whatever it is. I mean, the briefs contain, and the cases cited in the briefs contain references to specific statutes where minors are allowed to seek care and treatment for sexually transmitted disease without parents being there, and that they're liable for that, that they can seek that type of drug counseling. So that's, you know, the argument that they can't, that they can give informed consent for medical procedures, but they're not able to consent to the terms of an arbitration agreement to take a test, I think falls by the wayside. I mean, we know that people of all ages don't read their contracts. That's just a given. But you can't say, I read it, sign the contract, take the benefit of it, and then walk away. With respect to the argument of that this is an adhesion contract, there's two elements.
Mr. Miyagi, it just occurred to me. Should there be no acknowledgement, though, that this particular service, as opposed to medical services or other services that are, that a minor might want to contract for, is designed, is focused on minors because you would be taking advantage of this test or seeking to take these tests while you're a minor? Chances are that before you're going to college, you're going to be 16, 17, 18, maybe. But it's certainly within the contemplation of your business, of ACT's business, that they're going to be dealing with minors. And should there be some kind of acknowledgement or accommodation to the fact that these are very young individuals?
I think that's a very good question. And not being part of the electronic age, I would say that the convenience of a hyperlink is something that they find to be very useful and easy to handle. And I believe that's an acknowledgement of the current methodology, if you will, or method or format that younger people tend to communicate, especially if they're in college prep mode, if you will. And this is a young woman who, you know, graduated from Kamehameha Schools, which has first-class facilities, and I'm sure she's very computer literate. So I don't think that what ACT did was inappropriate given the current state of teaching for college prep students. But it is a valid question. So it goes back to where I started, if I may. It's a matter of the convenience. You could have, I suppose, if you want to accept Mr. Rosehill's argument, put the entire terms right before the box for she checks. Okay. But that doesn't guarantee that she's going to read it. If you accept Mr. Rosehill's argument, she would just scroll down, click the box, and move on. So the argument that putting it on a link versus putting it immediately before, I think, is not a valid one for setting aside the particular contract that we have before you to consider. With respect to the argument that this is a contract of adhesion, obviously there's two elements. One is that, you know, it's a take it or leave it, and we do understand that that is the reality of a test of this magnitude given across the country. However, is it really unfair? Is it really unconscionable? And we would suggest that it is not. Now, for example, if one goes to the court process to resolve these issues, take this case, for example. The test was done in 2007. This is 2011. The arbitration would have been done and ruled on within a very short period of time. That's a benefit to the student as well as to the ACT. It's a procedure that allows the expeditious resolution of these disputes. Both sides are limited to written submissions, but you can submit it. As a trial lawyer, one could say it's important to have the demeanor of the witness presented to the fact finder, etc. And I understand that being primarily a trial lawyer. However, this is a sword that cuts both ways. You know, if the child is less than forthright or less than believable, you know, that would hurt. But if the child is someone that's, you know, the next coming of, I'm trying to think of a figure or an example of someone, Abraham Lincoln, if you will, that would be to their benefit, but it cuts both ways. So neither side is allowed to have the demeanor of the witness before the fact finder, the arbitrator in that case. So I don't think it's unconscionable and it's not unfair. I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but the whole point is I believe that Judge Kim's ruling was the appropriate one, and that there was, in fact, I mean, the terms of the arbitration agreement are not in dispute. The only question is whether or not, based upon the arguments submitted by the plaintiff appellant, is whether or not this court should find that that arbitration agreement is not enforceable. And we believe that Judge Kim found that it was enforceable and that this matter should be sent to arbitration. I'm open to any questions.
Going back to whether this is a contract of adhesion and whether this some of the terms are unfair, in your answering brief, you say that the appellant, the student, will have the ability to submit a conflicts check and challenge, you say, challenge the arbitrator once selected. But you don't cite anything to the record on that point. Are you aware of anything in the record that establishes that?
I don't believe there is, that I'm aware of.
I don't have anything further, thanks.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple points to wrap things up. Justice Riker, you raised the issue about whether Alana Durrett in this case, about anything in the record dealing with the school she applied to. And I would direct the court to page 29 of the record. It was the last page of Alana Durrett's declaration that she submitted. She states the universities that she applied to and that she had been accepted, and that the ACT scores, she did not want those to be canceled. So the implication is that these are the scores I applied to. They required ACT scores. So there is a provision in the record that addresses that issue. The point that Mr. Miyagi makes, that she can't take the position that she didn't read, she can't say that because I didn't access the page, I'm not bound by the terms and conditions. In other words, if you don't read it, you're sort of bound because you didn't read it. And that very argument was raised by Netscape in the SPEC decision.
Could you give me the site for that case you just talked about, the SPEC?
The SPEC v. Netscape Commerce Corp. It's 306 F3rd 17. Second Circuit opinion in 2002.
Okay, thanks.
In that case, the plaintiff downloaded software without knowing the terms that applied to the purchase, and without reading those terms, Netscape argued that they failed to read the contract is no defense, and the parties nevertheless are bound to its terms. Same argument that ACT is raising here, and the court in that case concluded that consumers did not assent to the terms of the license agreement because they weren't properly notified of the terms. And that's the exact point that we're making here before this court, is that Alana Durrett as a minor was not properly notified of what she was agreeing to and those terms and conditions. And as I stated before, it has to be clear, it has to be conspicuous. And that was brought out in both the Brown and Douglas case about you've got to bold it, you've got to box it, you've got to clearly bring it to their attention. And I understand Mr. Miyagi's argument that an embedded web page is pretty common today. But what is also common today, and most of the majority of websites have moved away from embedded web pages, what you have now is a page where you scroll down and read the terms and conditions of a disclaimer or contractual provisions that apply to the website that you're on. And that's intended. So you read it, you can't very well say, I didn't read it, because it's there in front of you at the time you agree. It's there in front of you at the time you acknowledge it. And that's not the case here. He raised the issue about expeditious resolution, and we understand the need for expediency. But I think you need to weigh the expediency and the process against knowing
consent by a minor and bringing attention, bringing to their attention the terms that they're being bound to. And I think weighing those two issues, I think it sides more so with the minor that you have to tell me what I'm agreeing to, and certainly in the case of a minor. The other issue is that Judge Kim had the ability under the Federal Arbitration Act to, if there was any doubt as to whether there was an agreement to arbitrate, he could have set it for an evidentiary hearing. And that was one of the points that we raised in our briefs, is that there was an option. If there was a question in the court's mind, similar to a question of fact on a motion for summary judgment, he had the ability to set it for a hearing and take testimony on that issue. Was there knowing consent? What did she understand? And so forth. And he chose not to, and came to the conclusion that there was a clear understanding here.
Did he have that ability under Section 3 of the FAA? That's the appellee's argument, that they proceed under Section 3. You argue they proceed under Section 4.
Well, we cited the court to the Prima Paint case of the U.S. Supreme Court that said that the analysis is the same, whether under Section 3 or Section 4. It doesn't matter who pursues the arbitration. The issue is whether there was an issue of fact regarding was there clear agreement on the terms of arbitration. If there's any doubt in the court's mind, then the option available to the court is to hold a hearing on that or a trial on the issue. And we never got to that point with Judge Kim when we argued before him. I have nothing further to add if the court has any further questions.
I guess I have one last question. Do you view our decision here as sort of an all or nothing decision? Either there is no binding arbitration or all of the terms are available or are enforceable? I mean, is that your view of this case?
I would think under the circumstances, yes.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Thank you.